Happy International Women's Day. This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, March 8th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening to A World of Women. Here from Cameroon. Hear voices of women from Malaysia on this International Women's Day. And here you can hear Kurdish women expressing their solidarity on their own issues of breaking repressive traditions, joining a global consensus dedicated to reproductive rights, defense of families in poverty, and equal justice for women.
This is what democracy looks like.
These voices closer to home are from the Women's March in D.C. the day after inauguration 2017. Hundreds of thousands of people from around the USA, an apparent consensus to resist, to endorse many of the same issues that International Women's Day is speaking about today, but it's only apparent, that consensus.
I thought it was ridiculous to march.
Here are some common voices from rural Oklahoma just a week after that demonstration in D.C. Not impressed.
Of course, you know, you got to have your voice heard, and he didn't seem to be wanting to listen, so I don't know, but I really thought it was ridiculous. He won. Let's move on.
I didn't feel like me as a educated and conservative woman was being really appreciated, because in a lot of ways she was saying, you know, women are degraded and there's a war against women and, you know, women need to stand up and women need this. And I feel very content and satisfied with my life, and I feel like I've made choices to be here, and I don't feel like I, you know, have been disgraced or that I've been disadvantaged.
That was Jacqueline Pope, a traditional Democrat, and Meg Stewart, a traditional Republican. Their numbers are elusive. They are conservative and liberal alike. You won't catch them at any demonstrations. Their presence is undeniable in this country, though. The 61% of rural, non-college-educated women who voted for Donald Trump. Do they share a suspicion of this day and of the so-called progressive women's agenda? The visceral debate in this country over abortion and the liberal-conservative divide sets the U.S. apart from a wider global consensus on women's empowerment. And in a moment, we will look at the special divisions among the 175 million or so American women. But first, a look at the historical and now renewed importance of a day that traces its history back to the U.S. and the then-influential Socialist Party of America in the early 20th century, but arguably found a more radical home abroad for much of the next century. Today, women in over 50 countries advocate for labor rights and gender equality on this day. Kavita Ramdas is a feminist, activist, and philanthropic advisor, most recently with the Ford Foundation and the Global Fund for Women. She joins me now. Welcome to The Takeaway, Kavita.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Tell me a little bit about the history of International Women's Day and what it's come to represent globally.
Well, it's fascinating history because really in many ways, when I speak to Americans, I didn't grow up in this country. People don't have any idea that it has a relationship to extraordinary history in this country. And in fact, International Women's Day was very much inspired by some of the working women's movements in the United States as early as 1908. And then particularly in the aftermath of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York City, where 140 immigrant women, mainly Jewish and Italian women, lost their lives. But I think because it was associated, the Socialist Party of America at the time called for a Women's Day.
Right.
And then the Socialist International took up that call and unanimously sort of supported the idea. It sort of fell out of favor for a long time in the United States. And then I think the United Nations reappropriated it in 1975 as a UN holiday and as a sort of a UN day of commemoration of women's struggles.
And as a UN day, how has it proceeded and what sort of consensus does it seem to represent?
It has lost that groundedness in a way in a working women's struggle for justice, for equality, for equal wages, for suffrage. And I think that in some ways what has been so inspiring about recent events in the United States, particularly the Women's March in January of this year, is that there was that quality of active resistance, that sense of bread and roses, if you will, that, again, sort of was a revival of that sense that there's something particular about a Women's Day that is both grounded in a struggle for social justice and economic justice, but also that is leavened with this sense of hearts starve as well as bodies give us bread and give us roses.
I think what we find around the world is that the notion of women's empowerment is often right at the point of collision of modernity and, you know, traditional notions of political hierarchy and paternity and modern politics.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, in some ways, although I think the struggle for women's emancipation has been cast as a struggle between modernity and tradition and often even between sort of Western culture and non-Western culture,
right.
I think the history I just described and the history we actually know about what it took to get the vote in the so-called Western world belies that myth. I think there's a history of patriarchy and a culture of patriarchy that has been a global culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some ways the women's revolution for full emancipation is perhaps the most revolutionary of all social movements because it does not turn on a class that is somewhere far away, but that it's deeply intimate. It is within the confines and the very deeply intimate spaces of personal relationships. And therefore, I guess I would say that in my experience as an Indian woman, having grown up in India and then now being an American citizen, I think that there are very different ways in which, in some places, I would argue that the so-called developing world is far ahead of the so-called developed world in terms of struggles for women's emancipation, struggles for women's liberation, and the grounding of those struggles in a broader struggle against inequality, economic inequality, and an economic system that is highly exploitative. I think in the U.S., they have become separated for a while, and I think what has been very reassuring in some ways to me about this most recent resurgence of a women's movement has been that it has chosen to reintegrate a much more intersectional view of what it means to fight for freedom and that our freedom as women is inextricably linked with the freedom of workers, with the freedom of immigrants, with the freedom of black people, with the freedom of, you know, people who have been marginalized. So I don't know whether I would cast it anymore as a struggle between modernity and tradition.
Kavita Ramdas, feminist activist and philanthropic advisor, thank you so much.
It's been great to be with you.
So are we in the United States behind in some sense? Have we left a global consensus on the merging of tradition and emergence of women's power around the world? Do our deep divisions today politically suggest we've reached a kind of limit of emancipation for women? Marjorie Sproul is a history professor at the University of South Carolina and author of the recently released book Divided We Stand, The Battle Over Women's Rights and Family Values That Polarized American Politics. Professor Sproul, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So how did the debates that we have today form in the 1970s in a period of history where women's rights became a debate over some very select issues about family values and particularly reproductive rights?
Well, the women's movement took off first before this conservative women's movement rose up in opposition. And in the United States, the women's movement actually made extraordinary gains. It transformed the society, really, and made a lot of gains that we've not ever lost up to this point, though some are threatened. And the conservative women's movement came along in opposition as many women who were more deeply invested in traditional relationships felt like their way of life was being threatened. And they rose up in opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment because they were distressed that politicians in both parties seemed to be taking feminists as speaking for all women. And as these issues that are very personal, loaded with religious and moral significance, reached the forefront of national politics, it became much more difficult for there to be, you know, rational discourse on these matters. Compromise becomes almost a dirty word and consensus impossible. And then when the two political parties in 1980 ended up taking sides, the Democrats continued to support the women's rights movement. The Republicans declared themselves the party of family values. Then you add partisanship to polarization, and you end up with the political culture that we have now.
Do you think we'll ever reach a consensus that there will be a single notion of women's rights and that political debates over some of these other questions will be, separate?
Well, you know, I think that women on both sides of the divide and their supporters agree on a lot of things. There's a stereotype that the conservative women don't support women in the professions, for example, or women in equal opportunities of education. And for the most part, they do. But these real sticking points, it seems, tend to be things on which conservative religious groups feel very strongly. Most important, abortion, but also on the issues of sexuality and gay and lesbian and transgender rights. And when you get to those kinds of issues, it's there that it seems that the divisions are very deep and lasting, and it's hard to see how people are going to work these things out. One of the things that is quite interesting to me and actually heartening is that from decades in which the conservative women's movement made feminism a dirty word, now everybody seems to want in on it, but on their own terms. And I think that's actually promising because it underscores what I said a minute ago, which is that there's so many issues on which they do agree that people do want to be considered feminist, which is not the way it's been for the last 20 or 30 years.
Marjorie Spruill is a history professor at the University of South Carolina and author of the book Divided We Stand, The Battle Over Women's Rights and Family Values That Polarized American Politics. On this International Women's Day, thank you so much, Marjorie.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
As Patti Smith said, gender is a drag, or is it? What does the future of inclusive gender look like to you?
This is Christine Sumption. I'm calling from Seattle, Washington. How would I make a more gender-inclusive world? Embrace the radical idea that women are people. Reject sexism as the idiocy it is. Also, equal pay.
My name is Daniel Dillard, calling from Fort Collins, Colorado. I believe that we need to educate kids in schools about the gender issue. That's the only way that we can stomp out the ignorance. It's a step-by-step process that we need to be patient with, but we also need to demand equality.
From Charlotte, North Carolina, I've found myself questioning every interaction I have with women these days. Women have been held to such a low station in our culture for such a long time. I'm glad my generation can take a hand in correcting it. Give us a call. What do you think about all this at 8778-MY-TAKE or join the conversation on our Facebook page.
The Takeaway is supported by Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at floridathefutureishere.com. And Squarespace, a website building platform that helps businesses, entrepreneurs, and individuals to create websites, portfolios, online stores, and more. Learn more at squarespace.com. Squarespace, make your next move.
Oh, WikiLeaks, what would we do without you? Well, the latest addition to our checks and balances here in the 21st century gave us another peek at government surveillance capability, and it is formidable. The first batch of Vault 7, that's a series of documents allegedly describing secret files about software tools used by the CIA to break into smartphones, computers, and even the most sophisticated televisions. Encryption, as a result of these documents, may actually be a myth at this point, and corporations may be much more vulnerable than we have been led to believe. Jake Williams is the founder of Rendition InfoSec, an information security firm based in Augusta, Georgia. Welcome to The Takeaway, Jake.
Hi, how's it going?
So how alarming was it to go through this pretty large, and they're describing it as the largest classified document dump from CIA files?
Right. So I'll tell you, nobody, I think, has been through all of it yet. It's more than 8,000 pages of documents. But I'll say a lot of the stuff that's in there is pretty concerning.
Concerning in the sense that the CIA is just developing capability after capability after capability and not being terribly concerned about our privacy? Or are they targeting particular capabilities and going after individuals and institutions with some sort of strategy in mind, as opposed to just getting better features in their various tools?
I don't think that we can tell which of those two it is from the documents that have been released, but from what we've seen, there are some pretty outstanding work on developing tools to bypass security features. There's a whole set of tools designed to bypass the antivirus that organizations would normally use to keep their information secure.
How much complicity do you think there is, or can you tell if there is, between corporations or makers of digital tools and software developers and the government?
Yeah, so far of the documents that we've reviewed, there's no evidence that there's any complicity there. I think actually after the Snowden leaks and the fallout from that RSA had with the encryption stuff, I really don't think any U.S. company today is going to be complicit in any of that going forward.
So this looks really nasty, this Vault 7 stuff. It's very much a privacy bypassing, a sort of look, you know, put a window on people's living rooms kind of software program.
Yeah, potentially. I will say that I highly doubt that the NSA is targeting me or you or my mom, any of that. But seriously, when it comes down to it, the problem is once these tools get out there and these techniques get out there, it's no longer just the CIA that has them. And,
right.
And people with less regulatory oversight and less moral scruples may reuse some of these tools.
And what evidence is there that these tools are circulating, that they're not actually safe in the files of the CIA?
Well, so WikiLeaks has already said that they have additional data that they haven't dumped yet, and presumably a large portion of this are the actual tools themselves. Already in the files that they've dumped, they detail techniques, and there are even source code snippets that would allow attackers to emulate some of the CIA's tool set.
So that means that in addition to these dumps and descriptions, there's actual libraries of techniques and ways to use actual individual, say, televisions, for instance, as listening devices.
Yeah, so that specific code didn't get leaked yet. The description of what they were doing with the Samsung TVs, for instance, did.
And the Weeping Angel code is something that someone could go in and find in this WikiLeaks dump and target a Samsung smart television.
Well, specifically the Weeping Angel code, I don't believe was the code itself wasn't released. The description of it was. But if you look in the dump, there's a lot of it that WikiLeaks has redacted initially, but said that at a later time when there's a consensus among the WikiLeaks members, they may choose to release.
So this does show some sort of, constraint on the part of WikiLeaks. But, where's this consensus going to come from? We'll know from them whether they want to get rid of the redactions or not.
Yeah, I think that's where we're left. But I don't want to underscore the stuff that's already been released. There's a lot of potentially damaging information in that. Particularly that we're concerned about is attackers being able to use some of those techniques and repurpose them and target American corporations.
And when you look at the list of techniques called Umbridge, these are the kinds of things that foreign users or foreign cyber attackers would take from this dump and use against U.S. corporations. It already seems as though there's plenty of tools out there from the Chinese and the Russians.
Yeah, I agree with that. And in fact, some of the Umbridge stuff was actually designed to, according to the documents, to help basically the CIA blend in and look like other hackers already, whether it was China or Russia or whatever the case was. But again, when we start looking at some of the specific techniques that they used and even some of the specific code that they used, this is the kind of thing that helps foreign organizations that have less of a research budget than CIA, kind of levels that playing field a little bit.
Do we think that the CIA has a good handle on what it's trying to accomplish here, or that it's, as the Snowden documents seem to suggest, is an agency kind of out of control in questions of bypassing encryption and making privacy a thing of the past?
Yeah, I mean that's a really good question, and I don't know that we can see that from the specific dumps themselves. I know there's a lot of regulatory oversight, with the CIA, and I certainly hope that they're following all of that, especially given some of the tools that are alleged in the documents.
How hard would it be for them to target you and to get everything that your computers have based on what you've looked at so far?
Well, so I'll tell you the same thing that I tell my clients, right? When you're targeted by a nation state, you know, whether that's the CIA, the NSA, or some foreign intelligence service, it really doesn't matter who you are. You're not going to keep them out. It's just a matter of detecting them and responding.
Jake Williams is the founder of Rendition InfoSec, an information security firm based in Augusta, Georgia. Thanks so much, Jake.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. First looks at the GOP Obamacare replacement bill have already produced howls of shock and criticism from some conservatives who claim it's an expensive, non-coercive, but still non-viable government spending boom. The American Health Care Act, as it's called in its early form from the House GOP Monday night, may spell trouble for millions of seniors. The AARP and other lobbyists say citizens 50 to 60 years old could face premium hikes of up to $3,000 a year. And that means, according to Max Richman, who's president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, and a former staff director of the Senate Special Committee on Aging, it means that the GOP bill could actually encourage under 65-year-old seniors to get rid of their insurance coverage.
The Affordable Care Act, contrary to a lot of the myths that were spread back in 2010 and 11, did not take money from Medicare beneficiaries. It reduced reimbursement rates that allowed Medicare beneficiaries to have increased benefits, lowered the cost of prescription drugs, provided for the first time ever under the Medicare program preventative services such as colonoscopies, mammograms, diabetes screening, an annual wellness visit. It's unclear what will happen to these improvements, as well as to the 12 years of solvency that was added to the Medicare program by virtue of the Affordable Care Act. What we are also very concerned about is what's going to happen to the Medicaid program. It's my understanding that about $370 billion will be reduced in federal Medicaid spending over the last over the next 10 years. Now, keep in mind, people should understand that 60% of seniors, or more than that, a little more than that, will end up needing nursing home care or home care, and that's provided by the most part by the Medicaid program. This would have a dramatic impact on seniors. So Medicare beneficiaries could suffer. Medicaid beneficiaries could suffer. Those who are 50 to 64 will end up paying more for insurance because the age rating is being moved from three times the amount insurers are allowed to charge younger people to five times. And the states have the flexibility to broaden that even further.
Well, that's the issue. I mean, they describe this as an incentive program for insurance, but you're describing that at the very moment where people most need insurance between 50 and 64, the prices are going to go up so high that they would actually be encouraged to go off insurance and just wait for Medicare if they don't have some health problem by the time they're 65, right?
Right. And yeah, exactly. And what happens then? They wait. We already know that often people will, when they get close to age 65, will put off medical care until they have become eligible for Medicare. Therefore, when they do become eligible, they're in poorer health because they haven't taken care of their health needs. Now that's going to be aggravated. We're going to have changes to these programs that are going to have serious negative impacts on the health of older people, Medicare beneficiaries. And we're going to have people putting off the needed health care who are 50 to 64. They're going to come into Medicare eligibility worse off in terms of their health. And the program is not going to have the kinds of improvements, we think, that are provided in the Affordable Care Act. So how does this help anybody? You know, that's the question Americans need to start asking their members of Congress. And I think they're starting to ask them in these town hall meetings.
Max Richman is president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare and former staff director of the Senate Special Committee on Aging. Max Richman, thanks so much.
Thanks for the invitation.
So when Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself from the investigation into Russian meddling in the U.S. elections, Rod Rosenstein became the man in charge. That is, if he's confirmed to be the new deputy attorney general. Rosenstein faced tough questioning on the Hill about his ties to Russia yesterday and whether he would appoint a special prosecutor to the investigation. Rosenstein would not commit to putting a special counsel in place. How surprising was that? And will the deputy attorney general show up in a Saturday Night Live skit this weekend? Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is watching all of this. What do you think, Todd?
Well, John, as you said, there is a new AG, Jeff Sessions, but he's done that recusal from all of the FBI and DOJ investigations. So now oversight for those does fall to Rod Rosenstein. At his nomination hearing yesterday, as you mentioned, Democrats leaned on Rosenstein hard. They want him to commit to appointing a special prosecutor. Really, this was a way for Democrats to continue highlighting this issue because they think they're getting good press out of it and good pressure on the Trump administration. But Republicans had questions, too. Here's chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He's Chuck Grassley.
How would you handle such an investigation? Have you ever discussed with the attorney general the appointment of a special prosecutor to handle such an investigation?
Well, how I would handle an investigation, Senator, is the way I would handle any investigation. As far as I'm concerned, every investigation conducted by the Department of Justice is an independent investigation. We prosecute tens of thousands of people every year, and every one of those defendants deserves an independent prosecutor.
There's Rod Rosenstein talking to Chuck Grassley. Now, he would not commit to that special prosecutor. Democrats said they were demanding it. But who is this guy? Most Americans haven't heard about Rosenstein, but he's been behind the scenes at a lot of really important times throughout the recent legal history of this country. He's a Harvard law grad. He was 12 years a U.S. attorney in Maryland. And at DOJ, Rod Rosenstein has been involved in some very high profile and politically toxic investigations over the years. But he still managed, John, to maintain a reputation for impartiality from both Republicans and Democrats, and that's probably what's led to his moment here. He was part of the independent counsel team of Ken Starr in the 90s, investigating Whitewater, the land deal involving the Clintons right in Arkansas. Yeah, he was also just one of a small handful of U.S. attorneys who were asked to stay in their jobs between the George W. Bush and Obama administrations. And during the Obama years, he was called on to investigate leaks about classified information and drone strikes in the Obama administration. Now, Democrats spent most of the hearing yesterday trying to get Rosenstein to commit to this special counsel. They didn't really seem to have too many problems with Rosenstein himself. As I said, he's got all of this bipartisan cred. Chuck Schumer is on the Judiciary Committee. He's also, of course, the Democratic leader. And I asked him after the hearing what he thought of Rosenstein's refusal.
Look, I think he's a fine man. I was disappointed that he didn't say at the hearing that he would call on a special prosecutor. I'm still hopeful he will. When he looks at the guidelines, it's really the best, far and away the best alternative. And I'm hopeful that a seasoned, unbiased prosecutor like Rosenstein will see that.
What? How much of a red herring is this whole special prosecutor, special attorney issue here? Rosenstein said very carefully that every investigation is, you know, independent. It's got its own prosecutor to it. Maybe Rosenstein is being disingenuous there. What's the difference between a regular prosecutor and a special prosecutor?
Well, it's a way to remove control of an investigation from the administration completely. And certainly the optics of a special prosecutor, let's be honest, might send the message that there is some sort of malfeasance to investigate, right? That's why the opposition would so much want a special prosecutor. Look, Capitol Hill investigations, John, into the Russia connections in the election are continuing. Of course, Devin Nunes, who is the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, said that he'll have an open hearing on March 20th, that's Monday, where former intel and current intel officials will come and testify. So those investigations on the Hill continue. And back at DOJ, now that Jeff Sessions has recused himself, you're going to be hearing probably a lot more from the likes of Rod Rosenstein in the coming weeks and months, if you haven't heard from him already, as he's likely to be confirmed as deputy AG.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
You bet, John.
We heard earlier this hour that Russia's International Women's Day is a day for giving flowers, and the cut flower markets all over Russia are overrun with roses and male buyers this week. Here is Russian President Vladimir Putin himself delivering his annual speech congratulating Russian women.
Dear women of Russia, mothers, grandmothers, daughters, wives, girlfriends, our nearest and dearest, my warmest congratulations on International Women's Day.
Author Lisa Dickey is an expert on the remarkable and very painful changes that took place during the years after the fall of the Soviet Union. She's traveled through the country three times in 1995, 2005, and 2015. She wrote a book about her experiences called Bears in the Streets, Three Journeys Across a Changing Russia.
I feel like eons has happened just in the 25, 26 years since the breakup. It's night and day between 1995, the first trip that I did, and 2015. You know, in 1995, it was just 4 years out from the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the ruble had collapsed, and people had lost their life savings, and they didn't know what was going to come next. And there was just this great uncertainty. It was just really chaotic. And then if you compare that to 2015, the ruble has definitely had a bit of a collapse in the last couple of years due to oil prices and the sanctions. But overall, you know, the economy was more stable. Some money had flowed out into the cities in the mid-2000s when, you know, the oil prices had gone up. And all of a sudden, you know, new bridges are being built and new apartment buildings. And, you know, in 2015, this latest trip, I was in Novosibirsk. I have literally never been in a city where I had seen this many new construction projects going on at once in the downtown of a city. I mean, it was just unbelievable.
And the tracking of this history that you describe is also seen in the way Russians view the United States. That's been radically different, even though in the United States, you know, Russia has barely figured until now when it's an obsession in this early
right.
days of the Trump administration.
You actually have to go back and look at, you know, the Soviet era when there were two superpowers, us and them. And then after the collapse of the Soviet Union, suddenly there was one superpower and everybody started talking about China being on the ascent. And nobody really cared about what was going on in Russia in this country. You know, a lot of the people I talked to said, I'd love to go to America. I think America's really cool. And, you know, we're so glad you're here. And this is really cool that you're, you know, coming through. And then, you know, in 2005, suddenly people were like, all right, we have a little bit more stability. We have a little bit more money. We want to be taken seriously. And I really saw it this time around where there's definitely a feeling. I mean, the title of my book, Bears in the Streets, came from the fact that people in all these different cities kept saying to me, well, you guys all think we just have bears wandering in the streets here. And what it seemed to me to be indicative of is they think we don't take them seriously and they really want to be taken seriously. You guys don't take us seriously and you're going to be taking us seriously soon enough. And sure enough, we are. I mean, we're talking about Russia all the time now. And certainly having all of these things that are going on with the were there meetings, were there not meetings, is there hacking, is there spying, like all of this really does feel like a throwback to the Cold War era.
Is it hard for people to be nostalgic in the way that Americans are nostalgic for, say, the 1950s? I mean, white Americans, I suppose, are nostalgic for the 1950s. Nostalgia is a tough business in Russia.
Nostalgia is tricky, but I will say, you know, like so many people are nostalgic for the Soviet period. I mean, they really are. I mean, there was recently a poll that suggested that, you know, the Russians' opinion of Joseph Stalin is as high as it has been in decades. And I had a lot of people talk to me. I even had one really wealthy family who seems like they're the epitome of, okay, this like capitalism in Russia has really worked out for this family. Let's put it that way. But they were both like, we really miss certain things about the Soviet Union. We missed everybody being on the same team. We missed waking up in the morning and knowing how much things were going to cost and, you know, essentially what the ruble was going to be worth. You know, so there's definitely a lot of nostalgia and a lot of people feeling like that they miss certain things about the Soviet Union.
The weakness that's apparent in the chaos of the Trump administration, does that make Russians sort of feel great that finally you guys are getting a comeuppance?
People did talk a lot with me about, you know, this feeling that America had gotten too big for its britches, essentially, that we were involved in a lot of their business. It contributed to a sense of nationalism for Russians in the sense that they were like, you know what, you guys have done these sanctions, but they're not hurting us at all, and it's only going to come back and bite you in the butt, essentially. You know, there's a lot of T-shirts and bumper stickers and stuff like that. There's one of Vladimir Putin, who's, you know, a black belt in karate, wearing his karate gear and kicking Barack Obama in the face and basically saying, this is our answer to your sanctions. There's definitely a feeling of Russian people feeling like they want to unite for a stronger Russia. And Vladimir Putin's the guy to lead them to that promised land.
Do you see signs of Russian economic instability or political instability when you're there these days?
One of So when I went there in the fall of 2015, the ruble had fallen in value by half. So I talked to one guy who had bought his wife a brand new car as a gift, and he'd bought it on a dollar-based loan because the ruble is too volatile. You know, suddenly instead of owing $40,000 on this car he bought for her, he owes $80,000. So people were really suffering. But then I would say, well, are you unhappy with your government? Are you unhappy with Putin? And they were like, no, 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 it's not his fault. It's you guys' fault.
What's the first thing you would tell that is invisible outside of the conspiracy theories and the silliness that you see on Saturday Night Live?
You know, the only thing we talk about when we talk about Russia, two things. Number one is Vladimir Putin. And number two is Vladimir Putin. That's all we talk about. And there are 140 plus million other Russians. And one of the things I wanted to do with this book was just to say, like, we just don't know what to think about the Russian people at all. We have these ideas in our head that they're all sort of like dour and dark and drinking vodka all the time. And one of the things I wanted to do with my book is just say, like, look, they're not so different from us. They may really dislike our government, which they do, but they were all incredibly welcoming to me, and they were very careful to make a distinction between what they feel about the American government and what they feel about the American people. And so many people said to me, we're so glad you're here. We're so glad you've come to talk to us, to listen to us, to hear what we have to say. We want to hear what you have to say. They hate the fact that our countries are at odds this way. But, you know, I feel like it behooves us to understand who the Russian people are. And in understanding who they are, we can better understand also why their government is so popular and why Putin maintains the control that he does.
Lisa Dickey, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Lisa Dickey is the author of Bears in the Streets, Three Journeys Across a Changing Russia. 76-year-old Michael Bornstein claims he can remember getting a tattoo way back in 1945, the way the needle punctured his skin to put a number on his wrist, a number that's still there. Michael Bornstein was among the youngest survivors of the Auschwitz concentration camp when it was liberated by the Soviets in January of 1945. He was 4 years old. Born in 1940 in Nazi-occupied Poland, after his family was able to delay their deportation for years, he eventually spent 6 months in Auschwitz, where he survived by hiding in his mother's bunk.
My mother always had a saying, Gamze Ya'avor, which in Hebrew means, this too shall pass. And when things get bad, she wanted to be optimistic and look to the future.
Michael stayed silent about his experiences during the war for most of his life, but that changed when he saw a picture of his four-year-old self in Auschwitz in those infamous striped pajamas in an archival image from a website denying the Holocaust. As a Jewish resident of the United States for many years, Michael finally decided to tell his story. And with the help of his daughter, journalist Debbie Bornstein-Hollenstadt, he wrote Survivors Club, the true story of a very young prisoner of Auschwitz.
My family all asked a lot of questions, and I was very shy in talking about it. But finally, one by one, my four kids, 11 grandkids, and especially Debola, made an impact, and we came out
with it. We broke them down.
Well, you're a journalist, right? So
I am.
The nudger in chief, I suppose. You've got to tell your story, Dad.
Yeah, you know what, though? This is the one story I never thought I'd get. He was pretty insistent that he didn't want to talk about this for most of my life. And so I gave up and I became a journalist instead and told everybody else's story. But finally got the one I really wanted to tell.
Families who are Holocaust survivors have in common the idea that the story is everybody's, that it doesn't just reside in one person. How has that been the case for you?
Well, basically, we didn't talk about it, but things have changed. Holocaust survivors are getting older or non-existent. One of the youngest survivors from Auschwitz, and that made a huge difference.
He realized he needed to talk now, you know, and it's exactly what you said. His story is relevant not just for our family. It's a reminder. And when, you know, I can't remember a better time in history to have this kind of reminder of what happens when bigotry goes unanswered.
What did you lose at Auschwitz?
I lost a lot in Auschwitz. I lost my brother. I lost my father. I lost 3 out of 4 grandparents. So it was major. And Debbie was able to get a lot of the information that I didn't have about my father, my brother. We got information from Yad Vashem, a Jewish museum in Israel, and it made all the difference.
There were a lot of answers, you know, that he didn't have. He was only four at Liberation. And so one of the reasons he was hesitant to talk, I think, too, is just because he didn't want to misrepresent history. And so to me, as a journalist, you don't stop there. You find answers. So we were fortunate that, you know, Nazis kept good documentation. And the Soviets who liberated him kept good documentation. His mother did tell us stories. One relative in hiding kept an incredibly meticulous diary that his family graciously shared with us. So when you put all the pieces together, you know, getting those answers, there's been closure.
One of the things that we did find, Debbie found, was information about my father. He was president of the Judenrat, which is basically a go-between the Nazis and the Jewish people. And after he saw what was happening, he encouraged a lot of people to hide, to flee, set up soup kitchens, and it made a lot of difference to me that he was a good man.
Four-year-olds, having had a few myself, remember things in strange patterns and strange collages of smells particularly and tastes and then just the visuals. What are the strongest memories that you have?
Well, as you mentioned, I was 4 years old, so I'm not sure if it's real remembrance or what people have told me, but I do seem to remember the smell of burning flesh in the ovens. When I'm on a subway now, I think about cattle cars being transported in crowded areas, and I remember that. One other thing that I seem to remember is washing in very cold water, and when I take a hot shower, it just comes to me.
And you remember the tattoo.
And I certainly remember the tattoo. There have been numerous times when I've thought about removing the tattoo. There have been numerous times where I've thought about changing my name from Bornstein to Born or Borns or something like that. But I think memory is important, and this is part of memory.
And the tattoo is part of you?
And the tattoo is definitely part of me.
The other night, we were in Washington, D.C. for a taping, and I was so struck by the fact that a waiter, we were out to dinner, said, "Oh, what are you in town for?" And my dad started to tell him about the book, and he rolled up his sleeve, and he showed his tattoo. That would not have happened 10, 15 years ago. My father kept his sleeves rolled down, and it was kind of struck me as a good reminder of how far, you know, the family's come.
Do you think it's okay to feel safe now?
I feel very, very proud to be an American, and I became a U.S. citizen in 1957, and that is extremely important to me. But I can't say that I feel completely safe. When you look at the alt-right and the anti-Semitism that is going on now, and that really bothers me, and I think it needs to stop. I think someone needs to make it stop.
Michael and Debbie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Michael Bornstein is a Holocaust survivor and author of Survivors Club, the true story of a very young prisoner of Auschwitz. And Debbie Bornstein-Hollenstadt is Michael's daughter, a TV news writer. She co-authored the book, which comes out this week. You've got a literary festival in Dubai, free entrance to cultural sites in Italy, and a campaign launched in the UK to get more women into politics. Just some of the many different ways that International Women's Day is being celebrated internationally. Strikes and protests around the globe, including in Dublin, Tokyo, and Rome. Here in the U.S., some school districts are shut down for the day as the hashtag Day Without a Woman campaign leaves them without enough teachers. The concept of gender has changed a lot since the first International Women's Day back in 1909. What's your message for International Women's Day 2017?
This is Holly Freeman in Portland, Oregon. Give women absolute control of their bodies and reproduction. Create safety for women and children by supporting them across all ages. Educating everyone. Hold human traffickers and prostitution peddlers accountable. Investigate and prosecute war crimes and create policies that support not allowing countries to stop meeting their citizens' needs. That's a start.
Call us at 877-8MYTAKE or head to the Takeaways Facebook page and tell us your story. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, brain training with games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. From scientists working with university researchers to explore new areas in human cognition. Learn more at lumosity.com. New York Presbyterian, where two Ivy League medical schools combine in their commitment to teach, practice, and expand the frontiers of medicine. Amazing things are happening here. More at nyp.org/amazingadvances. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.